Hello, everybody. I kind of didn't know where to go, so I went over there, and then I thought, the blend's coming up. And anyway, here I am. It's been kind of a wild week at the Downing House. Ben's mom's been in and out of the ER. Turns out she's fine. But normally my deep prep for theological, it didn't happen. So here we are. I'm glad to see you here. I'm glad to see that on such a beautiful day that you're not all at the beach. I see some of you are. And for those of you, I hope you're having enough fun for all of us and that you'll turn into YouTube later. And there's no condemnation, but that's from Romans, and that's not what we're talking about today. So Jeremy already talked to you about communion and how to do that. We'll have a few more instructions because it'll be different today. And, I was so tempted because we have this. And I thought, that is so close to my roots of having the kneeling rail for communion and coming up. And, I was tempted. But it seems like we've got enough logistical problems, so we're going to forgo that. But speaking of liturgical things, your teaching team get together monthly. And we muse together and think, what should we be speaking about and come up with creative ideas. And every once in a while, something comes up that's a little different. And a month ago, we started talking about what would happen if we inserted a few liturgical elements into liminal. Now, yay, someone said yes. Yay, there's two. We're a very untraditional church. But you can make a tradition out of being untraditional, too. And sometimes it's kind of fun to remember the baby that got thrown out with decades of bathwater. So this morning, I want to start with responsive reading. And so I will say a little bit, and then you're going to respond, Lord of all, to you we raise this our hymn of grateful praise. And to those of you who are old church people, you will recognize that this comes from a song called For the Beauty of the Earth. But if we could just pause for a moment and breathe and breathe out the noise and the clamor that the world would have to offer. Breathe in the curiosity and wonder of the immeasurable, wonderful surprises that God has for us. Breathe out the past and the future and breathe in this present moment. For the beauty of the earth, for the glory of the skies, for the love which from our birth over and around us lies. Lord of all, to you we raise this our song of grateful praise. For the wonder of each hour of the day and of the night, hill and valley, tree and flower, sun and moon and stars of light. Lord of all, to you we raise this our song of grateful praise. For yourself, best gift divine, drawing hearts and minds above, yielding to God's grand design, your pure sacrifice of love. Lord of all, to you we raise this our song of grateful praise. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. So, this morning, we continue our journey through the Sermon on the Mount. By my count, we're past the midpoint. I think we're nearing the end, just a few more weeks left. This week, we're taking a look at Matthew 7, 12, 20. And I'll tell you a funny thing. Yesterday, as I was starting to prepare the PowerPoints, I thought, I've picked the wrong week. I'm doing the wrong sermon. And I thought, well, we're just going to go with it. Turns out it was correct. But that's the kind of week that I've had. But this week, we talk about what we call the golden rule. And I'd like to read it again out of the Message translation, which I, like Catherine, had never thought of preparing a sermon using the Message because, it's not real. But turns out it's really, really good. So, and sometimes, you know, familiarity can breed contempt. And so in this case, I'm hoping that it doesn't at least breed complacency. So here's what the message says. Here's a simple rule of thumb guide for behavior. Ask yourself what you want people to do for you, and then grab the initiative and do it for them. Add up God's law and the prophets, and this is what you get. Short, simple, easy to hear, so difficult to do. These particular verses depart a bit from the pattern of the Sermon on the Mount, though, don't they? Where Jesus says, "You have heard it said, but I say." But here, Jesus doesn't do that. As a matter of fact, he relates what they've heard before, millions of times. The verse comes straight out of Leviticus 19, 17 to 18. And Jesus boils it down and says, if you add up God's law, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and all the stuff that the prophets say, it results in treating each other as though we would like to be treated ourselves. So normally you'd expect me to launch into treating others nicely because I want to be treated nicely, right? Kindly, generously, you know the drill. And that's the thing, you do know the drill. So I'm going to do just what Jesus did. Assume that you know this, and then look at the words from a little bit of a different perspective. And here's where I take the diamond that we talk about and look at a different facet. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And then Leviticus says, love your neighbor as you love yourself. See, the problem is not that we don't do this. We all know how to be nice and kind, right? The problem is that we do it. What? That is a problem? I'll say it again. We probably already treat others the way we treat ourselves to some extent, and that's not good news. Because we tend to not treat ourselves very nicely. I mean, think about some of the self-talk that goes on. You know, you drop something, you say idiot or whatever you say. We don't treat each other nice, or we don't treat ourselves nicely physically. We don't treat ourselves nicely emotionally. We certainly don't treat ourselves nicely spiritually. We all know what we need to do to obtain optimum health, right? Eat healthy foods, move more, rest, drink lots of water. Do we do it? No. We all know what to do to be healthy emotionally. We meditate, we journal our feelings, we find someone to talk to, we form deep friendships, we're present with what we're feeling rather than suppressing it, etc. Do we do that? No. We all know what we need to do to be healthy spiritually. Spend time with God. Read the Bible. Pray. Meet with other believers to encourage one another. Worship God. Sabbath rest. Do we do that? No? Well, we're in good company. Apparently, the Apostle Paul had the same thing, same problem that we have. He says, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. So does it surprise anyone that the way we treat others is lacking if we treat them the same lackluster way that we treat ourselves? Now, Ben and I have been on a journey since February to get our health under control because our weight, our cholesterol, our blood pressure, our blood sugar levels were all teetering on problematic, and in some cases they'd tipped over. So we signed up for a class through our medical provider that addressed various things that we should do to turn things around. And since February, we've each lost somewhere around 20 pounds. And people have said, how have you been so successful? And I'll tell you the secret. You know all those things you know you're supposed to do to be healthy? We did them. I'm surprised. Who would have seen that coming? The solution was always there. We just didn't take advantage of it. We know what we need to do. We just don't do it. It's like we're back in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve knew what they were supposed to do. They just didn't do it. The consequences for them were devastating. The consequences for us are as well. What if we treated ourselves well, did the things we know that are good for us, and then because we're operating out of a healthy and abundant spiritual connection, What if we could then treat people in a way that would build them up rather than tear them down? That would encourage them rather than discourage? What if we lightened their load rather than adding weight to it? What if we were slow to lose patience and looked for a way of being constructive? What if we weren't possessive, weren't anxious to impress, or if we didn't nourish inflated ideas of our own importance? What if we had good manners and didn't pursue selfish advantage with others, over others? What if we weren't touchy? What if we didn't keep account of evil or gloat over when our enemies fail? What if we knew no limit to endurance, no end to trust, no fading of hope? What if we loved like that? What if we took the time to enter other people's perspectives and see what it would like to be them before or even instead of judging them? What if we were brave enough to lovingly confront those who are not acting lovingly, those who exclude, who hate, who take advantage of others, and challenge them to consider a higher and a better way to be in this world? What if we knew a better way to navigate our lives? Would we do it? Should we? Could we? But the bigger question, will we? And that brings us to the next section, how. Let's see what our passage from the book of Matthew says about it. Don't look for shortcuts to God. The market is flooded with surefire, easygoing formulas for a successful life that can be practiced in your spare time. Don't fall for that stuff, even though crowds of people do. The way to life, to God, is vigorous and requires total attention. Now, we talk a lot about our authentic selves here, the self that lies deep underneath all the defense mechanisms and the masks and false identities that we pile on top of it, so that we'll be safe and happy and secure and free from worry. That's really an exercise in futility. Think of this. If you have a rose bush that is capable of producing lovely blossoms, do you dig a deep hole and bury it so that the aphids and the mildew and the frost don't get to it? That's just silliness, isn't it? But that's what we've done with our authentic selves. We've buried us so deep in order to protect ourselves that we've forgotten or lost who we really are. We take the easy road, the one that's advertised on TV, and instead of dealing with what causes food addiction, we took a pill for it. And surprise, it doesn't work. We have financial problems, and they're overwhelming, so we go shopping to feel better. Not speaking of anyone specific, of course. And then surprise, surprise, we feel worse and we condemn ourselves, but instead we still keep the shiny thing because we know it's the last one. And then we do it again next week. We do what everyone else is doing. And surprise, surprise, we, the beloved of God, have the same problems that everyone else has. And we can conclude that God doesn't care about us. And this whole Christianity thing doesn't work. Good Lord, but we're stupid sheep sometimes. We're beloved sheep, but stupid. So what does the Matthew passage say about that? Or next. Beware of false preachers who smile a lot, dripping with practiced sincerity. Chances are they're out to rip you off in some way or another. Don't be impressed with charisma. Thank you. Look for character. Who preachers are is the main thing, not what they say. A genuine leader will never exploit your emotions or your pocketbook. These diseased trees with their bad apples are going to be chopped down and burned. Now, I find this verse, especially this translation, in equal parts encouraging and terrifying. First of all, the encouraging part. I was asked once by a visitor, what we do at Liminal to ensure that our leadership doesn't fall into the Christian celebrity culture. I assured her that there were some things that make this highly unlikely. First of all, we don't have a pastor or a teacher who is the one. You will notice that not one of our teaching team members, none of us, can do what Neo is doing. And we don't have the cool sunglasses. And this may be Jeremy. Nope. Okay, we're good. Anyway, if you're looking for a teacher who is one, the one, don't look up here. Second, we're not a wealthy church. We don't pay our leadership team, and we just give a small stipend for the teachers who are up here on a Sunday morning. We pay small stipends to our administrator, the children's and youth leaders. You'll note that none of us are driving a Rolls or a Bentley, and most of us have day jobs. Lastly, most of us are introverts, and we'd be horrified if someone put us behind a pedestal or on top of a pedestal. I personally wish this was this much taller. But here's my personal antidote for celebrity. I have no personality. I know, zip it. I know some of you are being nice and you're disagreeing with me, but I have it on good authority. I've been diagnosed by a professional. I have no personality. It is true. A few decades ago, I decided to fix our financial woes by taking a shortcut that seemed like a sure thing. I would go on a game show and win tens of thousands of dollars. Password. I'm so good at password. You know the premise. You team up with a celebrity, and one of you gets a word or the password. And you try to make your teammate say the word before the other person does. Like if the password is down, I say up, and you say, yeah, you got it. I watched it religiously, and I became so, so good at it. I found out how to try out for it. So I drove down to Warner Brothers, and I was shown to a room with about 25 or 30 other hopefuls auditioned in front of the producer, or probably the producer's assistant. I don't think you meet the real producer unless you get on. The interviews were filmed for posterity, I assume, and we played several games in various iterations, and I was flawless. I gave brilliant clues, and when I was on the receiving end, I guessed every single one of the clues on the first shot. My scores were higher than the next leading contestant by at least 30 points. I was confident. I was on the way to password superstardom. We took a break, and the producer's assistant excused herself to contemplate who, beside the flawless me, would be lucky enough to be chosen. In the fullness of time, and that is a phrase that I've come to hate because what it means is that it's way past the time that you think should be the fullness of time, the producer's assistant returned, and I was ready. I smiled confidently, but I had also practiced my smile of condolence. Is it good? I practiced my smiles. Sidebar. I found out the other day that I don't actually smile. I was saying something to one of my people at work, and she said, you know, you'd be more accessible if you smiled. And I said, what are you talking about? I smile all the time. Every time I see someone in the hallway, I smile. And she goes, no, you don't. I go, yeah, I do. I do this. You see it? You see it? You got to attend. Anyway, this one, I was smiling confidently, waiting for my name to be called, for the accolades to pour over me. I had already decided I would be gracious and kind to the losers who weren't picked up for the three available spots. In my mind, I'm nice. So, assistant producer called us back to her seat, and her opening salvo went like this. Thank you all for coming. As you know, we only have three available slots to fill today. I hope you all had fun trying out. We, of course, look at a variety of things. Skill, of course, but even more, personality. There were a few of you who did exceedingly well in the skill category. But you have no personality. And this is an entertainment show, so personality is key. So the winners are, and she rattled off three names who were not me, which left me with one conclusion. I have no personality. But on the bright side, it's highly unlikely that I will ever be tempted by and succumb to Christian celebrity culture. Besides, I look stupid in sequins. So if you're worried about that, breathe in, breathe out, you're safe. So that's the encouraging part. But the terrifying part is more of a concern to me. As a teacher, who I am is far more important than what I say. Because if I don't do what I say, my life is going to show it. And no doubt, you will notice it as well. And I will have to wear the scarlet H on my chest, letting everyone know that I am indeed a hypocrite. I'm responsible for what I say up here, responsible to be sure it is true to the best of my knowledge, to be sure that it is something either I have done, am doing, or am attempting to do to the best of my ability, to be sure that my motives are as pure as I'm capable of having, with your best in mind, not mine, to be sure that I'm accurately representing God and what I believe God would have me say to myself and to you. And I will be held accountable for it. It's a tall order, and it's terrifying. And I'm hoping that all the rest of the teaching team here isn't going to bolt for the door, because it's true for y'all too. Well, these verses challenge us to evaluate our leaders. And a means of evaluation is by the fruit and the messages that our leaders' lives produce. And here's some questions that you might ask yourself in terms of our messages. First of all, is what we're saying true? Secondly, does it align with what I know about God, what you know about God? Is it applicable to your lives? Is it something that you need to address in your life now? Is it something that the teacher believes strongly enough that he or she is actually doing it? Well, that's scary for the teachers, but here comes the really scary part, the most terrifying truth of this message. The 7 or 8 teachers you see up here on a Saturday morning are not the only ones who give messages. No, we all do. And not just on Sundays. We do it all the time, every day. Our lives, our words, our actions all give messages that leave a far more lasting impression than anything any of our teachers will say on a given Sunday. So in a sense, this verse is applicable to all of us and to all of you. Let's read the verse again from the New International Version this time. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ferocious wolves. By their fruit, you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but bad trees bear bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire, and thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Now, I'm going to go off script. Dan told me I could, so I'm going to. This is it's a very dualistic passage, right? You're good or you're bad. You're, you know, in heaven or hell, basically. It's a literary device. We all know that this faith thing that we're on is a journey. It's a trajectory. And I think we should look at it more like this stock market. You know, it goes up and down and up and down, but with God's help, mostly it goes up. The general trajectory is in that direction. That's kind of how our faith journey is. We have good days, we have bad days. We have days that are just meh. And those are probably the most dangerous. But anyway, I don't want you to look at this that, you know, if you slip up, you've got a fast track to hell. That's not what this is about. It's just it's making a contrast. So, literary device. Anyway, moving on. So when I read these verses, I kind of want to be the good tree, don't you? Yeah, I want to be good. I want to be the product of my life to be faithful, flavorful, nourishing, abundant, in something that matters. Yeah, I want to be a good tree. So what makes a good tree? Well, first of all, it has to have a good root structure. We have to grow deep. Our roots need to penetrate into the source of nourishment, and our source is God. So we need to attend to our roots and make sure they're firmly fixed in God rather than what the world would have to offer. As King David wrote, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of our Lord God. They're brought to their knees and fall, but we rise up and stand firm." Why? Good roots. Second, trees need sunlight. Trees use sunlight to power photosynthesis, a process by which they convert carbon dioxide and water into sugar and energy. And for me, that's magic, because I'm not sciencey. But for you sciencey people, that makes sense to you. For me, when I took botany, I learned to draw really good cells so it would offset my grades. But trees need to use light. So do we. Sunlight, yes, but even more, walking in the light of our Creator. John 18:12 records Jesus' words, "I'm the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Next, trees need water. Trees absorb water through their roots, and it's essential for transporting nutrients, maintaining cell structure, and facilitating, again, photosynthesis. And boy, howdy, do I wish I'd paid more attention in botany. But anyway, we also need water, the H2O kind, of course, and also the living water that comes from Jesus. John 4:14 puts it this way, "But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him, or her, will become in him, or her, a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Living water. Trees need nutrients, including nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, which are absorbed from the soil into their roots. These nutrients are vital for all kinds of biological processes, again, the chlorophyll production and root development. We also need nutrients, don't we? Physical, of course, but also spiritual. John 6:35 says, "Jesus declared, 'I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry.'" And trees need space. Trees need space to grow their roots and branches, allowing them to access the sunlight and the water and the nutrients effectively. We need space. White space. I have a reminder in my house that my family thinks is hilarious, and I think they think I've slipped a gear. I have a large frame. It's like that, yeah, with nothing in it. And it's at the top of my staircase, so every time I go up, I see it. It reminds me, I need white space in my life, room to breathe, room to think, room to rest, room to hang out with God. Sometimes my grandchildren put little sticky notes in there, little smiley faces, or the ones who are more artistic, they draw little animals or such. I leave them for a while because they think they're really cute, but it needs to be white space for me. Well, the bottom line is this. We need to take care of ourselves, physically, emotionally, and especially spiritually. If we don't, anything we do will come from a deficit, and the love that we give to others will be stretched thin and will be unsustainable. We have to be the mom who puts her own oxygen mask on first before she helps her children with theirs. We have access to the abundant life. We know how to avail ourselves of it. It's offered to us freely, and it's lavished upon us consistently. But we need to notice it. We need to receive it. We need to live in it. Wayne talked last week and said that a good parent does not give his or her child a snake when they ask for a fish. But here's the thing. We need to be sure we're asking for a real fish and not a snake in fish clothing. Right? God knows how to give good gifts to his children. We don't know how to receive them. We tend to want what we want, when we want it, without a thought of whether it's actually good for us or not. And when we do not receive from God, we likely don't recognize it is because we don't receive the snake that we ask for, but got a fish instead. So to sum it up, yes, treat others as you would like to be treated. But be sure you're treating yourself as well, so you are able to reach out to others from a place of abundance rather than deficit. And by all means, learn to feed your soul. Find your true self and learn to love it. This next quote, man, I worked hard to put it up there because one of my character flaws is I don't care for the Beatles. Please don't hate me. Thank you. But I'm kind of a classical girl. But anyway, sometimes John Lennon did really say some beautiful things, and here's one of them. We need to learn to love ourselves first, in all our glory and all our imperfections. If we cannot love ourselves, we cannot fully open to our ability to love others or our potential to create. All hope for a better world rests in this. Well, as we close, I'd like to invite you to take communion. Communion is a sacrament, a holy moment. It's a time to remind ourselves of one who was in essence love. This is the point where I should have said, and the band can go forward. Sorry. This is a time to remind ourselves of the one who is in essence love, and out of that love, loved us. When you take the bread and eat it, remember that Jesus offered his body as a sacrifice of love. When you take the juice, remember that Jesus allowed his blood to be spilled out of love. Remember that love, that love, as you take communion. Receive that love. Let it change you. Let it fill you. Let it remake you so that you can be an open channel of that love to others. Now, this morning, as we take communion, it's a little different, and I'm going to trust that you guys are not going to end up in a mob and fall all over each other, and there will be grape juice spilling everywhere. So if you wouldn't mind, if you'd come up this aisle here, there will be one communion table. I'm supposed to remind you, threaten you even, do not come up on the stage. The stage is not for you. Okay. So if you'd come up here and take Holy Communion, and then make your way this way if you're on this side, and good luck if you're on that side, but you're all adults, right? You can do this. So let me just say a quick prayer before we start. Holy God, you've given us fish. Let us learn to desire fish and not settle for snakes. Lord, as we come to take the blood and the body, the representation of what you did, let it matter to us. Let us remember how very much you love us. Let that matter to us. Let us remember that you've asked us to love one another. Let that matter to us. Lord, help us in this way to lead lives that matter to the kingdom. Let us make a difference in this broken, broken world. In your holy name, amen.